Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis.
So, welcome to the Saki on Sabbatical podcast series, Security Perimeter podcast series, and what I've decided to do is to kind of do what I've always wanted to do. Well, not what I've always wanted to do. There's lots of things that I've always wanted to do, but this is like one of the things that I've always wanted to do, which is to kind of to go through some of the controversies and debates of the Second World War, and to deal with them, and of course take the contrarian view, just because I'm Saki, which is what I usually do, and it's gonna be fun. I mean, I'm looking forward to doing this. It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be interesting for those of you who are students of mine and have taken history. This is going to be a little bit more of a detailed, in-depth look at some of the topics we covered in the course. And for those of you who have never been a student of mine at the university, don't worry. It's not that detailed, historically speaking, for someone who has not been exposed to this material. To not be able to understand, but it is going to be fun. And the first one I'm going to deal with is the one that's been like kind of like on my head for like the longest time, which recently the Russians have made this one even worse, which is like that Russia won the Second World War, that the Allies did nothing. This one just really, really gets me. Especially since the other day I saw this article in one of these, of course, you know, neutral news sources from Russia, where it says that, get this, Russia should be declared a global patrimony, or a global, what's that thing that they do? The UN declares certain areas like sort of like these global heritage. Yeah, that Russia should be declared a global heritage country, like the entire country and its people and its public toilets should be declared a heritage, a global heritage, because of what the Russians did in the Second World War. And that's what triggered this, and what you're about to hear. This is only actually going to be one episode, but I think it's looking more like it's going to be two. So this first episode, or this first series, which is going to be in two episodes, deals with what really happened in the Second World War. Is it true when the Russians say that they won the Second World War? And also to look at what the West did to kind of maybe contribute a little bit, possibly, to the victory over the Nazis, maybe just a little tiny bit. So that's one of the ones that I'm thinking that I'm going to do. Another one that I'm thinking I'm going to do is like the whole Versailles myth that Hitler used, and others in the Nazi Party used, that many historians use today to explain why Germany went Nazi and why the Second World War, that Versailles was just such a punishing agreement that it was almost inevitable that what would happen, that what happened in Germany would happen, and then therefore it was almost inevitable that we would get the Second World War, meaning that ultimately, therefore, the blame for the Second World War falls in the hands of those who drafted the Versailles Treaty. So that's the second one that I want to deal with, controversy, debate, whatever you want to call it. The third one, the one of Versailles, I think, is probably going to be a couple of episodes as well. The third one that I want to, that I've thought of up until now is the use of the atomic bomb in Japan by the United States during the Second World War. That one's gonna be a bit on the interesting side, I suspect, and it's gonna ruffle some feathers, that's for sure. But, you know, for those of you who know me, that's what I specialize in ruffling feathers. I think the one, the first one on Russia and the West and the Second World War is going to ruffle Russian feathers, I guess. I'm hoping Putin listens to it. I drop his name throughout the podcast quite a few times. And, of course, his neutral, autonomous, independent news sources, a.k.a. RT, Russia Today, and Sputnik. So I'm still trying to get myself banned from Russia, from visiting. You know, they have this list where people cannot visit Russia. And I'm still trying to get myself on that list. I don't know if I'm on that list, but... Mr. Vladimir Putin, if you're out there listening, please listen to this podcast and the next podcast, which explains honestly what really happened in the Second World War. And it's going to hopefully piss you off enough to get you to put me on that list. And I promise, I swear, if you send me a letter saying that, and I know you... If you need to, you can figure out what my email is. If you send me an email saying, or somebody from your office, of course it wouldn't be you, but if it would come from you directly, it would be even better. I promise, I swear, I will no longer pick on you in my Security Perimeter podcast episodes or my website, which is called thesecurityperimeter.com, which you should visit. Mr. Putin, and everybody else out there. So I hope you enjoy this series. This is the Saki on Sabbatical series. I know I'm looking forward to doing this. So I hope it's interesting, educational, and hopefully it sparks some debates at home with your, you know, with your family. If it does that, It's kind of done its job, I guess. I mean, if it's made you think about these issues. So I've thought of three, like I said. First is, like, you know, the whole argument that Russia won single-handedly the Second World War to the Versailles Treaty as the cause of the Second World War, or as a contributor, a significant contributor to the Second World War. And the third one is the atomic bomb. If you guys can think, guys and gals, of course, if you can think of any other possible themes from the Second World War that you'd like me to cover, I'd be more than willing to add it onto the list of three that I already have. So... rock on, and on to the podcast, part one of the, you know, who really won the Second World War. And I just want to warn you that I've been recording this in pieces, because it's just too long to do in one sitting. And, well, the audio quality varies a little bit, depending on environmental factors, I guess. But it's still totally understandable. So don't, and it's not annoying, not great quality kind of thing. The quality won't affect your, it won't get so bad that you're sitting there saying, I can't listen to this anymore. It's just too annoying. No, it's not even close to that. So there's just some variation in I guess overall quality. Some bits are better quality than they sound, better quality than other bits. But, you know, I'm not a professional podcaster. I don't charge anything for this. It costs me money. It costs me money to put to maintain the site, the web page site, and also the podcast site. And every time you guys download an episode, and please continue to download as many as you want to. This in no way is intended to discourage you from downloading an episode. I get charged every time somebody downloads or listens to an episode, which is great. Like I just said, please listen. I don't mind. This is what I want to do. And it gives me great pleasure to see the numbers of people who are listening to the podcast, to each podcast, which right now number in about 1,000, maybe a little bit more depending on the podcast, or a little bit less, about 1,000 per podcast globally. Strangely enough, for some reason, they don't listen to me in Russia. Russia is like the only country on the planet that doesn't show on my little map they give me where the podcast was listened to. It's the only country in the world where the podcast hasn't been listened. Do you think maybe they're possibly using VPNs to listen to the podcast? Because I mean, I've had listens from Haiti and some really poor parts of the world, Africa, Somalia. I've had hits from Somalia, of all places. So, and all of Europe, of course, and almost all of Asia, and just China, even China, communist red China. But for some reason, that those Russians, they don't want to listen to my podcast. You know? I don't know. It doesn't seem to interest them. Anyway, so without further ado, on to the actual podcast itself. Part one of the truth about who won the Second World War. And no, don't think I'm going to start talking about that crazy hypothesis I give for fun in class, in history class, which is that Greece won the Second World War. No. I don't mean that. I don't mean Greece. When I say that, it wasn't only the Russians. I mean the United States, Great Britain, Canada, basically those countries. Greece as well, but not wholly responsible for the victory of the war, as the Russians claim that they are wholly responsible for the victory of the Second World War. So, again, I'm blabbering. Enjoy the podcast. Give me some feedback, please. Nobody ever gives me feedback. You can write me at securityperimeter@gmail.com. And, if you like it, please tell me. If you think this is an interesting idea to continue, and give me some suggestions for some other controversial World War II topics to discuss. So again, now, without further ado, on to the actual podcast. I wanted to do this podcast for a while now. The idea for it emerged after looking at a number of articles that had been published in Russia Today and Sputnik News, which essentially dealt with the significant role that the overwhelmingly significant role that the Russian army played in the Second World War. And my purpose here is not to belittle that or to underestimate, what the Russian contribution was to the Second World War. The problem with these articles, though, that appeared in RT and in Sputnik, were that they were actually trying to essentially say that Russia had won the Second World War in Europe, and that's simply not true. And I mean, that's just more propaganda. It's incorrect. There's a lot of things that the West did, and what I want to do in this podcast is kind of go through a quick review, let's say, of the Second World War, comparing the contributions made by the Russians versus the contributions that were made by the Western allies.
So there's just this one thing that I want to talk about before I actually get into the nuts and bolts of what happened in Europe during the Second World War. This has to do with events leading up to the Second World War. You know, one of the things that Russia Today, RT, and Sputnik were putting a lot of emphasis on was the fact that Chamberlain was appeasing the Germans, and he was. There's no doubt whatsoever that that occurred, and that the French were essentially defensive and had practically no intentions of invading Germany. This is a fact. RT and Sputnik, you know, put a lot of emphasis on, but they forgot to mention something really, really important. Something that, made Hitler's invasion of Poland in September of 1939 possible. So, leading up to the invasion of Poland, the 23rd of August, in fact, 23 August 1939, the Russians and the Germans, the Nazi Germans and the Communist Russians, which is a crazy, crazy combination, sign a non-aggression pact. And part of this non-aggression pact, there's this secret clause where they essentially agree that they're going to partition Poland, that Germany is going to get essentially the western half of Poland and is going to annex the western half of Poland, and then the Russians are going to move in to protect, you know, and I'm doing air quotes right now, to protect the remaining part of Poland from German aggression. By occupying the eastern part of Germany. This pact, it's called the Ribbentrop-Molotov, or the Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement, was an absolute necessity for Germany to be able to start the Second World War. Hitler feared, he loathed, obviously, Communist Russia and Stalin, but he feared them at the same time. And he was concerned that if he did decide to go to war against Poland without a non-aggression treaty with the Russians, that quite possibly the Russians might get involved and try to stop German aggression in Poland. And by essentially signing this non-aggression pact on the 23rd of August 1939, Stalin and the Russians were essentially giving the Germans permission to start the Second World War. In fact, within a week of the signing of this agreement, the Germans invaded Poland. I don't think this is a coincidence. So the Russians, the Russian media, Russian academics, so forth, place a lot of emphasis, correctly so, on Chamberlain and his policies of appeasement toward the Germans, but they conveniently forget to mention the fact that Russia signed a secret agreement to partition Poland, essentially giving Germans permission to start the Second World War. So to wrap this thing up really quickly, because everybody over here is asleep, and I don't want to wake them up. It is quite late. This idea just came to me right now, so I really wanted to put it down. If we're going to put blame on someone for what triggered Hitler to start the Second World War, it was actually the Molotov-Ribbentrop, or the Ribbentrop-Molotov. I forgot how it's referred to. Molotov-Ribbentrop Treaty. That essentially gave permission to the Germans to start the Second World War. Sure, appeasement contributed, but in terms of like what was the actual trigger to the Second World War, that is most definitely the Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement between Russia and Germany, and not appeasement on the part of the British. In fact, the British had signed an alliance, a protective alliance of Poland, leading up to the invasion of Poland. So Mr. Putin, RT, and Sputnik News, and the rest of all those news outlets out there, come to the realization that Russia had a lot to do with the beginning of the Second World War.
The typical argument that the Russians use is that the Western allies essentially didn't do anything until June of 1944, when they invaded Normandy, and that for the entire period leading up to the invasion of Normandy, that the war had been essentially fought only by the Russians. And that's to some extent true, but it really does underestimate what the Western allies did, beginning with the invasion of Normandy in 1944. I really don't know how to begin, other than to say that the nuts and bolts of the Russian argument is that they The nuts and bolts of the Russian argument is, like I said before, one, that the Western allies really didn't do much until June of 1944. Number two, that so many Russians, millions, tens of millions of Russians were killed in were slaughtered, essentially, in the Eastern Front in the years leading up to the invasion of Normandy. So the way I like to think about this is that the contribution that that the Russians made to the war, to the victory of the Second World War, was just to put it bluntly, and it's a horrible way of putting it, they contributed bodies. They just threw men at the Germans. They really didn't have any real kind of strategy on how to fight the Germans until very late into the war. Their strategy in the beginning of the war was to just withdraw in a very kind of haphazard manner deeper into Russia, and to allow the Germans to essentially conquer hundreds of thousands of miles into Russia within a matter of weeks and just a couple of months. I mean, the Russians invaded in August of 1941, and by December of 1941, they were at the gates of Leningrad and Moscow, and almost and very deeply into the Caucasus in the south. So, in the beginning of the war, the Russians essentially, honestly, did nothing. And this, of course, is in the context of the fact that the Russians the Germans, when they did finally put Operation Barbarossa into play, you know, the invasion of Russia, many of the generals, especially Guderian, one of Germany's more famous generals from the Second World War, the hero of the victory of France, Guderian was absolutely livid with Hitler and the chiefs of staff back in Berlin, because Hitler just couldn't make up his mind whether or not he wanted to go for Leningrad or Moscow or Caucasus. So these massive army groups that were sent into Russia were being given almost daily orders to change their objectives. And, you know, sometimes they were told, okay, go for Moscow. And they headed for Moscow. And then a few days later, they were told, no, head south into the Caucasus. So the Russians are getting their, essentially their butts kicked in the context of a German army that's being extremely, extremely misguided which is being given orders that are somewhat incomprehensible to the commanders on the field. But in spite of this, Germany was able to make impressive gains in the first few months of the war. So, like I said, it's bodies as far as the Russians are concerned, and this is not something that the Russians deny. The Russians very openly say that, you know, we lost 25 million people in the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, as they referred to it, and the sacrifice that was made by the Russian people, and again, the emphasis being paid on the amount of people that were killed. So I don't want to minimize that, and it was significant. It did play a very important role, but what I do want to talk a little bit about is what the West did, and what the West did was essentially introduced logistics, appropriate technology to win the war. Combined arms is using, let's say, in the case of the Second World War, effectively using Navy ground forces and air forces in a combined attack manner. Combined arms means that if you go after, let's say, the army, you expose yourself to the Air Force. Or if you go after the Air Force, you expose yourself to the Navy. So this combined arms strategy that was essentially invented in the Second World War and implemented very effectively by the Germans, of course, but also by the West, made a very, very significant difference. The technology that the West developed, we always talk about, you know, the amazing technology that the Germans developed in the Second World War. They did, but the way, you know, what I tell my students in my history class is that there was kind of like technological attention deficit disorder going on in Germany, because they just couldn't decide what they were gonna focus their resources on. Were they going to build, you know, a jet that could do this, or a jet that can do that, or they just literally wanted to build everything. So they spent very, very limited. They spent resources that were limited to begin with, given the fact that the Germany is essentially a landlocked country at this time. On a multitude of projects, which was absolutely unnecessary, and a lot of money was spent on building and testing and so forth, equipment that was never used, or, you know, they built prototypes or a couple of prototypes, and then they switched into a different project, and it just went on throughout the entire war, which was a pretty good thing for the West, because the West focused more on the development of technologies that a very limited number of technological developments, but designed to complete the mission. The big joke is that the Germans were trying to build a rocket to go to the moon during the Second World War, while the Americans, what they're building is a plane that can fly high enough, pressurized, higher than what fighters can reach. So in other words, it's not vulnerable to attack by Japanese fighters. Long range, that can drop bombs on Tokyo. And that was, of course, the famous B-29, which was the plane, in fact, that was used to drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Americans developed a fighter that was one of the big problems that the West had was when they were bombing the crap out of German cities, literally flattening them. Most German cities with any kind of industrial capacity during the Second World War were flattened by the Americans and the British. They didn't have a plane that could escort, a fighter plane that could escort the bombers, the B-17 bombers on the part of the Americans and the Lancasters on the part of the British. They didn't have a plane that was sufficiently long range. Fighter planes with long range was something that just didn't seem to mix. Yet the Americans were able to develop a very, very effective plane, the P-51, which was extremely maneuverable, very high speed, and also had extremely long range. You could make it all the way to Germany, escorting those bombers, protecting those bombers, and then escorting them on their way back. Essentially saving those B-17s and Lancasters. And in the process, what these P-51s ended up doing was essentially annihilate the German Air Force, because while they were flying over Germany, because they were so much more superior design than what the Germans had at the time in large numbers, which was the Bf-109. The Messerschmitt Bf-109. Well, the Americans were able to essentially annihilate the Russian Air Force. The German Air Force, using these P-51s that were being sent up to shoot down the B-17s and the Lancasters. So, this focus, of course, on the P-51 obviously made a very significant difference. It wiped out the German Air Force, and which was an absolute necessity for the Allies to be able to make a landing in Normandy. There was no way a landing in Normandy could have been possible if the Germans still had anything close to a serious air force. Let's say that RT and President Putin really don't acknowledge the fact that the reason why Germany had no planes, let's say starting around the end of 1942, 1943, was precisely because of the Americans. When the Russians are fighting the Germans in the east, they're being attacked by German ground forces because the Americans have essentially annihilated the Russian Air Force, the German Air Force. But of course, Mr. Putin and Russian historians really don't acknowledge this. Obviously, the big technological invention that the West made during this time, in other words, instead of having attention deficit disorder and just like trying to build spaceships and stuff like that, was the Manhattan Project. Very expensive, but the Americans and the British who participated in the Manhattan Project, and the Canadians, by the way, who participated in the Manhattan Project, knew that they had to win this, that they knew that there was a, that the Germans were trying, and they knew that they had to win this this competition to build an atomic weapon. Fortunately, because the Germans had this attention deficit disorder issue, the Americans were, and the Americans, of course, and the Western Allies didn't. The West was able to put together the project and successfully develop the weapon, earlier than anybody else could. The combined arms, this focus on developing technologies. Oh, this is another thing that I wanna mention. A couple more things that I wanna mention, technologically speaking, is that the Americans by far had the best rifle in the Second World War, the M1 rifle. It was the first semi-automatic rifle. The Germans were still using bolt action rifles, which means that, you know, they had to point the thing and then do the bolt and then acquire their targets and stuff like that. But the Americans with the M1 were able to have a weapon that had a cartridge of, I think, 5 bullets. So that meant that they could keep their focus on the target for much longer. Very simple thing. A rifle, not a rocket to the moon, or just a rifle, made such a significant difference. When everybody else is using bolt action, the Americans are using the M1, which was extremely effective. The American soldier could fire 3 or 4 rounds in the time that it took a German soldier to fire 1 or 2 rounds. So that gave the Americans a significant advantage on the ground. Something else that I wanted to add was that Patton was a nutcase. He's a racist. He's an anti-Semite. I mean, he was obviously insane. He thought he was reincarnated, among other things. But he was by far the best general in the Second World War. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But Patton said what won the Second World War was the M1, that rifle that I just mentioned, and the Willy Jeep. The Americans gave themselves an extraordinary ability for mobility, with the invention of a Jeep. A mass-produced Jeep that was rugged, could go over different terrains, and give them the ability to perform very effective reconnaissance operations. There's this great scene in this TV series that I saw called Banner Brothers, where one of the German soldiers who has surrendered is just looking at the trucks, the transportation trucks the Americans have, and the jeeps and the tanks and all that stuff, which are going towards the east, while these soldiers have surrendered and therefore going into protected areas, into the western part of, I guess, France. And this German leader is just so impressed at this technological feat that the Americans have accomplished. And we're not talking about rockets. We're talking about jeeps and trucks and tanks. And one of the soldiers, one of the American soldiers in the movie, he screams out to the German, I think he must have been a general or something, and said, that's right, GM, Ford, that's what's winning the war. And I just thought that was such a great line and so indicative of the contribution that the Western powers made in the Second World War. This the ability, not so much the technology, but the ability to mass produce these vehicles and ships. We're not going to talk too much about the Navy because I'm not a big Navy guy, but this ability to just produce, the ability, the American factories, they were just like throwing out literally hundreds of vehicles and planes on a daily basis during the war. And there was just no way, absolutely no way, that the Germans could have done anything against this. So while the Russians are throwing bodies at the Germans, what the Americans are throwing at the Germans is GM and Ford, as that soldier mentioned. So here's something else that I wonder if RT and Sputnik and President Vladimir Putin would be so proud of to disseminate among public opinion in Russia and in the world, as far as their conduct in the war. And this brings us actually to the war itself and how the Russians prosecuted the war itself. Something that the Russians had was referred to as so-called honor battalions. And what these units were machine gun nests that were placed behind the advancing Russian soldiers, towards the German lines. And if any Russian turned around and ran back after the Germans had been, you know, firing, in other words, if any Russian decided that he wanted to retreat, well, these honor battalions would execute him. And that was what the Russians considered to be an adequate way to get their soldiers to really fight, you know, to really do the job that was necessary in this great patriotic war. And you gotta try to put yourself in the position of one of these Russian soldiers at this time. Are you going to get mowed down by German machine guns, or are you going to get mowed down by Russian machine guns? Either way, you are going to die. And that's just something that's so difficult for me to process, how these young Russian soldiers were able to go onto the field and march forward. I mean, they were basically knowing that they were going to die. And because, and some of you may have seen this in a movie called Enemy at the Gates, because the Russians had way more soldiers than they had rifles, they would issue one rifle per three soldiers, I think was the number. So the first soldier would go forward with the rifle, and then when he was shot, the second soldier, who followed closely behind, would pick up the rifle and move forward. And then when that second guy was shot, then the third one behind him would pick up the rifle and move forward, hopefully, with each body getting closer to the German line. I'm not quite sure that this is something that a country should be proud of in terms of I can't think of the word. I'm going to hit pause. I can't hit pause. There's no pause. How they prosecuted. There you go. That's the word. I'm not quite so sure that RT and Sputnik News and Vladimir Putin want to advertise how Russia or the Soviet Union at the time, of course, prosecuted the war in that regard, or how proud they would be for fighting the war in this manner. Essentially, just like I said earlier, throwing Russian bodies towards the Germans. And here's another little tidbit, air quotes, obviously. Obviously, Germany advanced, as I mentioned before, Germany advanced rather quickly and occupied vast swaths of Russian territory. They occupied Ukraine, Belarus, etc. And these territories were systematically, obviously, systematically, what's the word I'm looking at? And these territories were administered viciously by the Germans. But there were essentially three fighting forces that existed in these occupied territories, and this is an interesting story. The first fighting force, of course, were the Germans, who were trying to suppress the Soviet guerrillas, and the Soviet guerrillas, of course, the Soviet resistors, being the second group. But there was also a third group, who were, let's say, the Ukrainian nationalists, who hated both the Soviets and both the Germans. So the Ukrainian nationalists, for example, would go after both of who they considered their enemy to be, and the Soviet guerrillas. By the way, the Soviet guerrilla resistance movement was being controlled by Moscow, by the Central Committee. The Soviet resistance movement, of course, targeting not only the Germans that were in the occupied territories, but also the Ukrainian nationals. And of course, we know what the Nazis did. These are the areas that were administered not by the Wehrmacht, which was the German army, but rather by the SS. And this is where essentially the SS implemented its policy of essentially annihilating the people that lived there. And the interesting, the reason I bring this up is because I mentioned a few moments ago that the Russian resistance that was, let's say, the Soviet resistance that was in occupied Soviet territory, occupied by Germans in Soviet territory, this was being run, of course, by Moscow. It was being run by the Soviets. This wasn't a resistance movement that emerged on its own, and this resistance movement not only targeted those Ukrainian nationalists that I mentioned before, and they not only targeted those Germans that I mentioned before, but they also targeted Russians or Soviet citizens. And the point of this was to make sure that these people knew that it didn't matter that these territories were occupied by Hitler, that Stalin could still reach you. He could still get in there, and that Stalin could still reach you. And the Soviet resistance force was known for its brutality. They were equal to, if not worse than, well, no, that's kind of hard to say that they were worse than the SS, but they were at least equal to the SS in terms of how brutal they executed their so-called missions. And essentially, they were spending much more time killing civilians than they were killing Germans. So, in the end, who's paying the price here for this war? It's just your average Ukrainian citizen or Russian citizen in occupied Soviet Union who's being targeted by the SS on the one hand, or by the Soviet resistance by the other hand. And the level of brutality that occurred in these occupied territories is just, it's incomprehensible. It's not even a question of the number of people that were killed, which obviously is in the millions, but just the brutal nature of the fighting was unheard of. The fighting that took place on the Eastern Front was very visceral, I guess is the right word. There was a very deep hatred on the part of everyone, and they played out this hatred they demonstrated this visceral hatred much more towards civilian populations than they did towards each other, meaning the different fighting forces. Absolute brutality. And I wonder again if you know, how proud RT, Russia Today, and Sputnik and Vladimir Putin would be to admit that the Soviet government, in this great patriotic war, slaughtered its own people who it suspected might be collaborating with the other side. Even the possibility that some Ukrainian or some Russian was even thinking about possibly collaborating was enough to get you killed and tortured and raped and all these other nasty things. And, you know, when you read through these articles in RT, they don't seem to mention this, or rather, they don't mention what the Soviet government itself did to its own citizens in territory occupied by Germany. No, we're not talking about what the Germans did to Russians and Ukrainians in occupied territory. It was utter brutality, and I don't want to minimize this. I'm talking about what the Soviets did against their own citizens in these occupied territories. Utter brutality. A level of brutality unheard of in the history of mankind. And I really mean that, in the history of mankind.
Okay, so that covers episode one of this, what I hope is going to be a two-part series, maybe a three-part series, on, let's be polite and call it the Western contributions to the Second World War. In other words, it wasn't only the Russians that won the war, as is essentially being claimed by Vladimir Putin. So stay tuned. The next episode should be up in about a week. Being on sabbatical means that I am much more... that I have much more time, and I'm thoroughly enjoying this, and I'm trying to think of other series, World War II series that I can do other than the ones that I mentioned in the beginning. So stay tuned for episode two. of, I think what I called it in the beginning was, who really won the Second World War? Oh, and please give me some feedback. Give me some suggestions for possible other topics related to the Second World War. In fact, like I already thought of one already, which is the myth. I thought of another one that I didn't mention in the beginning of the podcast, which is like the myth that the Nazis were actually these amazing military strategists. They weren't. They actually sucked, and thank God that they were running the show. Otherwise, maybe Germany could have probably won the war. So thanks to the Nazis and their stupid military choices, they lost the war. So stay tuned for episode 2 of Who Won the War, coming in about a week. It's going